This episode is brought to you by VPP Simplified. Now you can get element by element tracking and guidance for your VPP journey. Every aspect of the VPP requirements in one easy-to-use interactive spreadsheet. It explains every sub-element in detail, contains an easy-to-read stoplight so you can track current status for each sub-element. It provides you with a three-step verification for completion of each sub-element. There's even a notes section for you to compile language that will eventually be used for your VPP application. It even comes complete with graphs to show current state and track your progress moving forward. Look, achieving VPP star status can be tough, but understanding what it takes to get there can be simplified. This VPP gap tool will help you do that. Go to vppsimplified.com for more information.
Welcome to the Safety Pro Podcast, where we help you manage workplace safety one episode at a time. And now, your very own safety pro, Blaine J. Hoffman.
Welcome to another episode of the Safety Pro Podcast. Another listener request today via email. I get many of those throughout the week, so please keep them coming. This one's about aerial lifts. We're going to dive into the OSHA requirements around programs that manage aerial lifts, training, things like that. We're going to get into some FAQs. These are, you know, frequently asked questions that I've gotten in the past, and you know, maybe you've been asking yourself from time to time, but hopefully at the end of this podcast episode, you're going to be able to walk away with everything you're going to need to get started looking at your aerial lift safety program, you know, inside your business. Before we jump into today's topic, of course, I want to stop, take a moment, and talk about the exclusive floor marking company of the Safety Pro Podcast, Mighty Line Tape. They know how important safety is to your organization, and the breadth of the Mighty Line product line covers everything you need to implement a 5S system for increased productivity in your facility and the safety of your workers. Mighty Line floor signs are a great product to regulate workplace traffic. These signs are customizable to fit exactly what your company needs. Just listen to some of these facts. Mighty Line floor tape is 7 times thicker than the average floor tape. Their patented technology makes it more durable than other floor tapes. The beveled edge increases durability for forklift traffic, and the peel and stick adhesive removes easily, and of course, it is all made right here in the USA. Go to mightylinetape.com/podcast for your free sample. That's right. You can sign up to get free samples sent directly to you. Just go to mightylinetape.com/podcast to get your sample today. Okay, so let's get into aerial lifts. What exactly are considered aerial lifts according to OSHA? Essentially, as you may already know, aerial lifts are simply vehicle-mounted device, either telescoping or articulating, or both, a combination of those, that are used to position workers, you know, at heights. Aerial equipment may be made of metal, wood, could be fiberglass, reinforced plastic, or other material. So don't get hung up too much about, you know, whether or not it's made out of, you know, one material or another. It may be powered or even manually operated, and are deemed to be aerial lifts, whether or not they're capable of even rotating about a substantially vertical axis. That's key. So you could be talking about an aerial lift, even if your particular lift is missing one or two components of what you would consider to be an articulated boom lift or aerial lift, okay? So these include aerial ladders, extensible boom platforms, articulating boom platforms, vertical towers, or any combination, okay? Now, keep in mind, aerial lifts, they don't include man lifts, scissor lifts, forklifts, or firefighting equipment. Those are different. We'll talk about scissor lifts here in a moment, but you know, we're going to start with aerial lifts and work our way from there. These devices, they must be designed and constructed in conformance with ANSI standards for vehicle-mounted elevating and rotating work platforms. That would be, oh, I had jotted it down. Hold on. ANSI A92.2. Got to look that up. ANSI standards, you got to buy those. So you're going to be paying for an ANSI standard. What you need to do is any aerial lift that you rent or purchase or lease, it's going to probably meet this standard. So just make sure the manufacturer can basically certifies that this meets all current ANSI standards. Now, the general industry regulations, they only address aerial lifts that are vehicle mounted with an elevating and rotating platform. For other types of equipment like scissor lifts, as I mentioned before, OSHA will utilize the general duty clause of the Occupational Safety and Health Act to hold employers responsible for safety. Okay, so scissor lifts are going to be, there is sort of an outlier. Aerial lifts has specific regs that we're going to discuss. The regs are found at 29 CFR 1910.67 for vehicle-mounted elevating and rotating work platforms. So the general duty clause that OSHA would refer to when citing an employer outside of that regulation would be the ANSI A92.2 through A92.9. So it goes A92.2, 0.5, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9. I often get asked, like, okay, what's the difference between some of these devices? We know an aerial device is any vehicle-mounted device, right? Telescoping or articulating or both, that's used to, you know, position workers to perform, you know, work, usually at heights, right? Or extending out. What's an aerial ladder? Okay, well, an aerial ladder is a device that it consists of a single or even a multiple section extensible ladder that goes out. The articulating boom platform is a component of, or could be a component of, an aerial device. An articulating boom platform is simply the aerial device that has two or more hinged boom sections. An extensible boom platform, according to OSHA, is an aerial device, except ladders, that have a telescopic or extensible boom. Telescopic derricks with personnel platform attachments are considered to be extendable boom platforms when used with a personnel platform. So you got to look at the individual components, but you don't have to have every one of these to be considered an aerial device. So according to OSHA, you know, a platform is any personnel carrying device. It's either a basket or a bucket, which is a component of an aerial device. So let's talk about some requirements that they're either ANSI, OSHA, letters of interpretation, or just best practices that you need to follow, right, with regards to aerial lifts. One, obviously, only trained and authorized persons are allowed to operate an aerial lift. This is a distinction worth noting. You could be trained in an aerial lift, but your employer may not have authorized you to operate one within their company. Does that make sense? You could have been suspended, or they just don't recognize or have not recognized your training as of yet, so therefore have not authorized you to operate one of these devices. So you need to be trained and authorized by the company. Basically allowed to operate an aerial lift. I get that a lot in the electrical standard as well. Somebody will say, hey, what's the difference between qualified and authorized? And I'm like, well, you're qualified by virtue of training and knowledge and the demonstrated ability to perform a task in a safe manner, whether it's electrical, whether it's operating a piece of equipment, aerial lift, forklift. That's how you're qualified. The employer will then authorize or allow you, grant you permission to perform those tasks or operate that equipment or that piece of machinery. So you have to first be qualified, trained, and then the employer must authorize you. They are two different things, okay? Furthermore, a qualified person has to conduct training and performs an evaluation of the trained operator. So it's sort of a copy of a copy of a copy. You could be a trained, qualified operator. That doesn't mean necessarily that you can be a trainer. There are some other things you need to be trained on to become a trainer. And we know this in the industry as typical phrase is a train-the-trainer course. So you've been operating a piece of equipment for a while. You're very proficient and you seem to be responsible. And the employer says, hey, would you like to be a trainer? Yeah, sure. Well, you should be going through a train-the-trainer course where you're presented with some training material. You understand the OSHA requirements on what is supposed to be documented, how the training is supposed to be administered, how would you evaluate or assess the training was comprehended or understood, the training was effective, what, you know, like I said, what written documentation must be maintained, all that good stuff. So you're going to have to get some additional training to be considered a qualified trainer. Now, the training, speaking of which, is a combination of, you know, items from the manufacturer's recommendation, the OSHA instructions, OSHA requirements, and even some of your own site policies as well have to be included in the training. So the training material is going to depend on the combination of that kind of information. Also, refresher training may be required. When this is required depends. It could be driven by a regulatory requirement. For example, in the forklift standard, every 3 years, it could be driven by an event. You either had an incident involving the piece of equipment, or you or somebody in the company witnesses or notices that an operator is performing their job in either an unsafe manner or, you know, not in accordance with instructed policies, procedures, or the training that they've received. It could also be triggered when you take that trained operator and put them into a different environment that they were not trained in. So instead of inside a flat, you know, warehouse, they're now outside loading and unloading trucks at, you know, at an outdoor dock, or you change the type of equipment that the operator is going to be operating. You are now changing the model, the type, the power source is different. It's now propane versus battery. You've got to train them or retrain them on those differences, or it could be a combination of those things. You completely take the operator out of the building into a whole different environment with a different piece of equipment. You may just retrain them altogether. Another thing is you've got to cover how to maintain these devices, right? So lifts have to be inspected. They got to be inspected prior to use in accordance with the manufacturer's recommendation in the operator's manual, which should always accompany the lift, should always be present. So that has to be done. How do you prove that an inspection or pre-use inspection was done? Maybe your company uses a card, a sign-off sheet, something like that. Many manufacturers provide such information if you want to use it. Another good tell, if you will, is if you can do your inspection on that lift and find something wrong and it wasn't noted, and yet it's still being operated, that's a good indication of they either pencil whipped the inspection or they missed it. And maybe that might be a sign that they need some retraining, refresher training as well. What about fall protection? In aerial lifts, fall protection must be used. Okay, it must be a personal fall arrest or travel restraint system that meets the requirements of 1910 subpart I and has to be attached to the boom or basket if it is designed for that. So the big issue in the industry has been, we hand our operators a full body harness and a 6-foot lanyard with a shock absorber. They hook it up and they snap it off to this little piece of metal angle that's at the mid rail right below the controls that's in the middle of this basket on this boom lift. Well, they're traveling around, driving around the site, driving around the plant, raising themselves up to do work. And if we look back at fall protection requirements, specifically with the lanyard and harness that the manufacturer says, you know, these conditions must be present before you can use these devices, one of them being a minimum height of 18 and a half feet before you can use this 6-foot lanyard with shock absorber. Well, you've got this thing on an operator who's running around on a, you know, in an aerial lift 10, 12 feet off the ground. You're not in compliance with the fall protection requirement because of the limitations placed upon you by the lanyard manufacturer. The lanyard manufacturer says you are required to have at least 18 and a half feet before using this lanyard. You've got to really be careful that you match the device with the situation you're putting employees in. Okay, so a fall restraint or an SRL, self-retracting lifeline, one that will keep or prevent the operator from being ejected or climbing out over or leaning over with their, you know, getting their center of gravity over that top rail. You know, that's your goal. The standard is clear that the operator's feet must remain on the deck at all times. So any fall protection device you provide them that allows them to, you know, stand on the toe rail or the mid rail, lean out over with one foot kicked out and leaning over to do some work, or get struck with another vehicle. You know, they're up doing some work and another vehicle backs into the base of the aerial lift and causes that boom to sort of catapult, if you will, and flex. You know, will the device they're using allow them to be ejected from the basket type of situation? That's sort of what you want to look at. You also want to make note of any capacity limits that are placed on you with the, you know, basket. If you're going to have two people up there, what's the rating for the basket and platform? Also, I've seen these things used as lifting devices where they'll put a hook or chain on the basket platform, like a little generator or something, and then with the operator go all the way up to the roof to set this generator on the roof with the basket, using it as a crane, if you will. So you got to watch that kind of stuff. Weather precautions are also important when you're operating these things outdoors. Ice, wind, rain, things like that. So you've got to have policies in place that cover all this stuff, okay? Power line safety. You know, do you have at your facility, if you're in manufacturing, and you've got operators that are going to be out back at the dock and the parking lot working, do you have overhead power lines that will be an issue? Okay, how will you insulate those? How will you instruct operators to perform tasks in those areas? Mostly facilities maintenance, right? Maintaining your facilities. You're going to talk about your maintenance personnel, but also don't forget about contractors. Even if you sub this stuff out, you have to tell them about the hazards that they may face when they come out and do this work. Any outriggers that are used, make sure that you cover where at in the facility outriggers can and cannot be used, whether they will or will not be supporting the outriggers. You could have something in a manufacturing shop where an outrigger goes down and it's on a metal plate that happens to be a small hatch over a pit and will give way under the weight of the outrigger. So you've got to be able to mark these areas in your facility, and they should be marked anyway, right? If you have a metal plate down in front of a press that is a pit to access to, you know, pump out or sump out or to do some oiling or maintenance work, or there's, you know, it's a confined space possibly, so it should be marked. You should also mark if something is just a hole cover and access cover that nobody's going to enter, but it will not support certain equipment. You should be marking these hazards. And not to go back to the beginning of the podcast, but you know, that's why we've partnered with a company like Mightyline Floor Tape. They have those types of solutions. So, you know, if you're going to truly support safety with, you know, all of your motor vehicle equipment, PIVs, your aerial lifts, scissor lifts, a big component of that is marking hazards throughout your facilities. So powered platforms, let's chat about that real quick. If you have anyone whose job requires them to use any of these devices, these power platforms, to perform maintenance work, then for the most part, as I alluded to earlier, they're going to be working at heights. So a fall hazard is going to exist. It is really, really important. I can't stress this enough, that they completely and fully understand the safe operation of the powered platform, as well as the requirements for fall protection, the limitations of their fall protection. They have to be able to perform a fall hazard assessment and an inspection of the platform they'll be operating. You have to highlight or focus in on those two aspects. You probably need to double down on those two, in my opinion. Once you get past basic operation, you really need to drive home this need for making sure that it is fit for duty, the device they're using, and that they truly understand where they are placing themselves, where a fall hazard exists, and matching the proper fall protection equipment to that hazard. Where you can find more information on that is in 29 CFR 1910.66. Okay, this covers employees who work on powered platform installations that are permanently dedicated to interior or exterior building maintenance of a specific structure. Building maintenance like window cleaning, caulking, metal polishing, and reglazing. So if you have these powered platforms that are permanently fixed or dedicated to exterior building parts of the building, like for window washing, for example, that you have to focus on that standard. If you're a contractor and you're going to be working on these things, like you're going to a host site and you're going to be working on their power platform to do some maintenance alongside their, you know, facilities personnel, you need to make sure this is really important. Make sure you have a written assurance from the owner, the building owner, the host employer, that the installation has been inspected, tested, and maintained in accordance with the requirements of the OSHA regulation before you allow your contract workers to get on the power platform, either by themselves, if they've, of course, they have to be trained, or alongside the host employer's personnel. You really, really, really have to make sure you do that. So, yes, only employees who are proficient in the operation, safe use, and inspection of the particular working platform can operate it. Powered platforms like that, the training needs to include a review of any emergency plans. And this goes back to fall protection as well. Basically, anytime you put somebody in a personal fall arrest system and they're working at heights, the employer is supposed to have an emergency or rescue plan to rescue somebody in the event of a fall so they're not just dangling there. You have to have that covered. Well, with powered platforms, it's even just as critical because, well, we've seen news stories. These powered platforms get lowered down from the roof and something happens and they're dangling up there with, you know, one or two cables and their fall arrest system for how long? How are we going to rescue these people 100 feet in the air? So, a review of emergency plans, also the safety hazards and preventative measures to be followed that will ensure the employee's safety. You got to cover the inspection, care, use, and system performance of the personal fall arrest system. You got to cover work procedures, and of course, the operation and inspection of the platform. So, contractors need to do this. If you're a window washing contractor and you're relying on the building owner has installed this platform and they rotate contracts with window washing folks, but they own and maintain that platform. That's the first thing you're going to ask for when you get that contract is, I want certification that that has been inspected, or you just do it yourself. You just eat that, right? Or you make it part of your bid, but you need to make sure that you have that certified, that it's in good operating condition and is ready for use, and then train your operators on that particular model. Certify your training with a written record. It shows the employee's name, signature of the employer or the trainer, and the date of the training. You keep that training record for the duration of that employee's employment, or indefinitely would be probably the safest bet, right? I mean, that's key right there. Training is going to be key in documenting the training. Now, let's talk a little bit about hazards, whether they're aerial lifts or powered platforms. What's unique about fall protection, working at heights, whether it's on a roof, in a pit, in a confined space, power platform, or aerial lift, is that it's different. Emergency procedures are going to be different than your average shop worker. A shop worker that gets an injury or an illness on the shop floor, the emergency response procedure is going to be slightly different. You're going to be able to access, for the most part, you're going to be able to access them and get them care, clear the area, have the medics come in with the gurney and you know, be able to load this employee up and take them out for emergency care. When you start adding, you know, the fact that they're 50 feet in the air on a roof where there's only a fixed ladder to get up there, or they're in a pit, or they are up on an aerial platform, you really have to pay attention to the emergency procedures. Extra care has to be taken to avoid injury while working on powered platforms. It's weird saying that. And so, because it implies that, well, if you're not working in any of these areas, then you don't have to be as careful. No, I think what I'm saying is that if there were a scenario where you really have to pause and ensure that you're doing something the right way, taking your time step by step, meticulously planning your steps, It is when you are in a dangerous or confined space. You're working at heights. You're on a roof where there's limited access to be able to rescue you or render care if you did even have a minor injury or illness while you were up there. So that's why I bring this up. That should be part of your training. You should be driving that message home. Also, tools. You know, it's a lot different when you're 100 feet in the air and you got the wrong tool with you. I mean, what are you going to do? Hoist yourself all the way back up to the roof, uncouple, get off, go down the elevator, grab the right tool. Chances are most folks are going to look at those two options and go, you know what, I'm going to make this tool work. That sort of drift from, you know, doing things the right way to justifying by saying, it's going to cost too much or it's going to take too much time. I'm only going to be doing this for a minute. Those justifications, those tiny little steps you take away from what we should be doing, those all increase your chances of an injury or illness. So ensuring that you're set up for success to do the job first is critical. So having a pre-job briefing, even a 5-minute talk about what you're going to be doing, and then going through an inventory in your tool bag to make sure, you know, yes, I have this. This is a critical tool, so I have two of them, things like that. That's going to be important. That should be part of your training as well. Having said that one, emergency procedures are sort of amplified or ramped up when you take a worker out of a normal working condition and you start throwing them 100 feet in the air or on a roof or up in a platform, an aerial lift or in a confined space or whatever. And also the tools and preparing them for that work, because once they're there, they're sort of committed to that situation. So, you know, having said that, workers have to be prepared to handle an emergency situation when either the equipment malfunctions or it's damaged during use or something like that. They have to be prepared. Part of preparing them might include emergency response training, some additional equipment that they have to keep with them, some sort of like survival stuff like water, bandages, two-way radio. If they get a cell phone that gets damaged or for some reason runs out of battery, they have to be able to communicate. You know, making sure that they have small lanyards for all their tools. They don't drop tools, things like that. You really have to roll that into your training program. Even in an aerial lift, just a boom lift inside a manufacturing shop, you're going to have to talk about the need for them to set up the area around and below the basket where they're going to be working up on this press or air compressor and the skylight or whatever. They're going to have to be able to set up this controlled access zone down and around that work area, because there's floor workers that may be walking underneath or in the proximity of that area, and you don't want to drop a wrench. You don't, you know, stuff like that. You have to include this in the training, and you have to make sure that operators understand that I'm not getting tunnel vision here. It's not just about me in this basket and needing to use this wrench right here and have my harness on, that there are also affected employees in this area. And I have to think about sort of that bubble. I had to widen that bubble or that sphere of safety to not just include myself, but others in this area. Who am I impacting or could impact in this area? All right. I talked about scissor lifts briefly. Now I'm going to get into it a little bit with scissor lifts. Now, OSHA says that a scissor lift essentially is a mobile scaffold. It's just that it's got a platform that moves vertically up and down, and can also be motorized to move horizontally across a floor or across the ground. Scissor lifts do not include aerial lifts, man lifts, mobile ladder stands, or tower scaffolds. So it's pretty clear. OSHA extensively addresses scissor lift requirements for the 1926 standards, right? Construction regulations. But there is no general industry standard, 1910 standard, that specifically covers scissor lifts. OSHA would utilize, for the most part, the general duty clause of the OSHA Act to hold employers responsible, as I mentioned before. So this is where you kind of need to think outside the box, where a lot of folks say, show me where it says I got to do that. Well, this is one of those gray areas where you don't have to show that operator or that foreman or that employer where it says I have to do this or that. You simply have to be able to demonstrate that by doing it the way you're going to do it, you are exposing employees to a recognized hazard that is or is likely to cause death or serious physical harm. I encourage you to reference the ANSI standards, manufacturer's instructions. Also, look up some letters of interpretation around scissor lifts, because there is no specific reg, but this is where you're going to get into trouble when you start wading into this, you know, this end of the pool, if you will. It gets a little murky. So with scissor lifts, a couple of things that come to mind. One, if the guardrail is not complete, then you're required to provide fall protection. The guardrail could not be complete by simply not attaching the chain or that mid-rail bar that at the end when you enter the scissor lift. There's usually a chain or a bar that slides up or a chain that latches. And I'll see that thing not latched. It's hanging down, dangling, and there's no mid-rail on the end of the scissor lift because that's where the operator comes off and gets on. So that would constitute an incomplete guardrail. That would require the operator to wear some sort of alternative fall protection because you can't rely on the guardrail anymore. Does that make sense? And just like aerial lifts and just like powered platforms, only a trained and authorized person can operate those. A cautionary note about personal fall arrest systems on scissor lifts. From personal experience, I know this to be true. An operator, maintenance operator, outside on a scissor lift in the parking lot changing a parking lot light, had the fall protection on, had a 6-foot lanyard, and was leaning too far out over the top rail. I won't go as far as saying that this individual was stepping on the mid rail or, you know, what. We're not sure. We can't prove that. But I do know this. The individual ended up falling over the top rail. The lanyard was engaged. The force of that free fall before the lanyard engaged was enough to pull that scissor lift over as it was fully extended up in the parking lot for this parking lot light. You can imagine it was quite high, 25 feet or so. Pulled the thing over and the individual was killed. Sometime after that, the co-workers in the maintenance department all acknowledged that they were under the impression that that rule of not leaning out over or standing on the tow board or even the mid-rail applied only because you weren't wearing the personal fall arrest system and lanyard. That if you had that on, that's what would prevent you from falling to the ground. If you were to fall out, it would keep you, you know, from reaching that eventual end, that sudden stop at the end we all talk about. So there was a fundamental lack of understanding about, you know, one, the physics of a fall, but two, the requirement to know you have to stay inside that basket, you know, and that's where the lack of a regulation does not help us, because in aerial lifts, it says quite plainly, the operator's feet shall remain on the floor of the basket. In scissor lifts, we don't have that kind of language at all. So it leaves it up to interpretation and it gets murky, as I said before. So you have to be careful with scissor lifts. Have a really strong written program. I would mirror aerial lift requirements as well. Always go back to the manufacturer. If the manufacturer says a fall restraint is required, or we have provided some tie-off points for a fall restraint, always ask the question, is that an engineered anchor point capable of withstanding the forces of a fall using a 6-foot lanyard over the top of that rail? And that would be, what, a safety factor of 2. The safety factor is based on the maximum arresting force of the lanyard. So if you have a lanyard that's capable of withstanding 900 pounds maximum, you need an engineered anchor point. A safety factor of 2 would be 1,800 pounds. So, you know, if the engineers say that that's what it's designed to do, that's what you need. You need that documentation. So you make sure that's clear. Don't just allow your operators to throw a snap hook on something that the manufacturer never intended to be used in that way. So you really have to be careful with scissor lifts and take extra care. You have to be a step ahead on these safety policies that you put in place in your facility. Okay, what about safety platforms that are attached to the forks of a forklift? Are those considered aerial lifts? Now, according to OSHA, you know, aerial lifts covered under 1910.67, vehicle-mounted elevating and rotating work platforms, and any vehicle-mounted device that telescopes, articulates, or both, which is used to position personnel. So a platform attached to the forks of a forklift would not be considered an aerial lift because it's missing those other components. Okay, so I hope I've touched on enough of this topic to get you started, to get you going down the path of developing a written program that manages all of the activities around aerial lifts and even some powered platforms and scissor lifts as well. We touched on that a little bit. But look, you have to make sure you treat these like you would your forklifts, right? There's very clear language around forklifts. You need to go back in your facilities and your policies and procedures and look at what we have established, look at who we have operating these devices, make sure that they've been trained properly and that we assess them for some period of time after, like annually at least, and that we also look at our facilities, the environment in which they're operating these pieces of equipment. Do we have policies and procedures in place to account for the atmosphere or the environment that they're going to be operating? So those are all important aspects of this program. So I hope that you will go back and you will look at those pieces. I want to hear from you. Let me know what you think. Shoot me an email. Hit that link in the show notes to send me an email. We're getting new listeners all the time. So if you're listening for the first time, go back and check out some of the other episodes. Be sure you hit that subscribe button either on Apple Podcasts or Google Play or whatever podcast app you're using. That way you won't miss an episode. If you think of it, leave a rank and review. That helps as well. And of course, I mentioned it earlier in the episode, check out the official floor marking and sign company of the Safety Pro Podcast, Mighty Line Tape. Go to mightylinetape.com/podcast for a free sample of the floor line tape. And until the next episode, as always, be safe.